Eat Drink Indiana Radio is brought to you by Eskenazi Health, one of Central Indiana's leading providers of health care with a focus on patient-centered care. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.
Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we are taking a cue from Women's History Month and focusing on some of the area's female chefs and restaurateurs. We'll hear from Martha Hoover of Cafe Patachou, Napoli's Petite Chou, and now Public Greens. And we'll also hear from Lisa Marino Moyer about her latest venture, Griner's Sub Shop. We'll talk to Tina Jessen of Tina's Traditional Old English Kitchen, which has recently expanded. We will hear about how baker Gwendolyn Rogers launched the Cake Bake Shop and what chef Jennifer Cheesem is up to with pierogies in a pinch. We'll also check in with Indie Food Swappers founder Suzanne Krowiak. So stay with us here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Restaurateur Martha Hoover launched the first Cafe Patachou 25 years ago and has taken the company from a neighborhood coffee shop to a local empire with cafes around town, three Napoli's pizzeria locations with more to come, a Petite Chou French bistro, and her latest, Public Greens, an urban kitchen with a mission, which funds Hoover's efforts to feed local children after school.
The newest restaurant in the group, Public Greens, seems like it's very out there as far as being at the head of changes.
Really, really proud of Public Greens. And I think it is a very unique and very different concept and a very different way of doing business.
It's very radical.
It is very radical. It's a cafeteria. And as you know, cafeterias are kind of a tired, worn-out norm.
Right.
I'm doing my best. I always say I'm doing my best to bring a ponytail back because I wear a ponytail every day. I'm also doing my best to bring cafeteria back. Cafeterias were started as, a wonderful sort to showcase food in a very user-friendly way. And somehow steam tables and bad food got in the way. And they really are a very irrelevant way to serve food. Our cafeteria is going to be a very ingredient-inspired restaurant. It's also associated with our own micro farm. Right. But even more radically unique, I think, is that the profits of this restaurant are going to our own foundation, the Patachou Foundation. And we established the foundation in 2013, so it's really brand new. It's a very startup foundation. We established it with the mission to feed healthy, quote-unquote, whole food to children in our community that suffer with daily food insecurity. We're making all the food in the production kitchen using the same quality of food that we would serve our customers. And we go to the Legacy Center, which is located on the campus of Arlington High School. And they have an after-school program they have an after-school program for five IPS schools. And the IPS schools are schools within the Near East Side. And most of the children that are in that after-school program, about 98% of the children, live at or below poverty, which in and of itself means that they live with daily food insecurity. So we feed these children in their after-school program. And beyond feeding, because there are lots of food throwers out there, and we really want it to be an impactful organization. So beyond feeding, we also have an education component to our programming. And again, this goes back to my staff. We have staff that are educators by education. They are, one is a nutritionist by education, and they have put together this remarkable curriculum that combines what we're doing with the food, and it's very age-based and very interactive, so that the kids are learning about truly the joys of the table. The children always get fresh fruit as their dessert. They always get organic, wonderful, natural produce, and they always get a really wonderful, natural protein. And they're really, the kids love it. You know, when we first started feeding them, I remember people telling us, people in the food world saying, in the food not-for-profit world saying, the kids aren't going to eat your food. They don't, that's not the kind of food they want. What we found was they not only wanted it, once they tasted it, they craved it. They wanted more, and they wanted to learn about it. I will never forget one of our first experiences with feeding children from the foundation was we made this wonderful, of course, homemade turkey vegetable soup. It was turkey vegetable soup that, you know, where the turkey stock cooked for 2 days. I mean, it was really a fabulous soup. And I will never forget a child having the first and second bite of the soup and looking up and saying, I'm not making this up. The child said, is this what they call real food? We had children who were astounded because they had never had meat in a soup that was larger than a little dice
a little canned soup, right?
And they were astounded by it. And they were astounded that they could have seconds. And it was, you know, it's heartwarming. It's heartwarming and heartbreaking at the same time. But we also are very proud that we have the same group of kids year after year. So this is now our second year.
Oh, nice.
So we're building relationships with the children. The interactive educational component is really fun for them. And our hope is that they are taking home this knowledge and telling their siblings and their parents and maybe making changes at home too.
Now, tell me how Public Greens is connected with feeding the children. There's a big purpose here behind Public Greens.
All of the profits from Public Greens will go straight to the foundation.
That is radical right there.
It is. It's a remarkable, it was a really a huge business decision to say that we are going to dedicate profits, 100% of the profits are going to be dedicated to a foundation. We're not a not-for-profit restaurant. We're a for-profit restaurant. So we will run it just like we run all of our other restaurants. Economic sustainability is huge. It's critical. But we've decided instead of using the profits the way we normally do, that we will dedicate them to the foundation so that we can take away one of the burdens that not-for-profits
have. The constant fundraising. Now, so the restaurant, I mean, it's not like it's going to be a small business sort of thing. I mean, you are right on the Monon Trail. You are in the middle of Broad Ripple. You're going to have a lot of business.
We hope so. We want to have a lot of business. No one goes into business thinking they will not have business. And our goal is to be very successful. You know, it's been the goal since 1989. This is not a hobby. This truly is a business. And Public Greens is not a hobby. It is a business, but it's a business with a deeper mission. And I think that people will understand and support the deeper mission.
We've been talking with Martha Hoover of Patashoo Inc. in Indianapolis. For more information on her local restaurants, including the latest, Public Greens, which funds the Patashoo Foundation and helps feed food insecure children in Indianapolis, go to cafepatashoo.com. How did a local food truck owner end up buying a Southside sandwich shop? As Lisa Moreno Moyer, who owns a Scout's Treats truck, as well as Bark Truck, tells us, it's kind of a funny story. But it's a story that's worked out well for the local entrepreneur who, in addition to her popular Treats Truck and Bark Truck, now owns Griner's Sub Shop, which has been in business since 1969.
Oh my gosh. It's a wonderful world at Raymond and Shelby. You know, and there's so much history here at Griner's. You know, it's been here since 1969. And from what I know, it's the oldest sub shop in Indy. And so I'm kind of calling that an institution, don't you think?
Absolutely.
I think so.
So now tell me about how you, why are you here? Why did you buy the sub shop?
Oh, my. Well, do you want the, I'm going to give you the shortened version of that. If I gave you the real true story of how I got here, I'm not sure you'd believe me. So I'll just say that I was given this incredible opportunity to find out about this shop. I'm from the north side. I'm now considering myself this new transplant south side girl, and I love it. I totally love it. Forget it. I'll tell you the truth. The truth of the matter is life's too short to not tell you the truth. I was online dating and met somebody and didn't want to date him, but I wanted to buy a sub shop. You asked. There you go. I know. Why hide it anymore, right? It's such a great story. You know, and I always say my motto in life is everyone has a story. And if you could have told me for 1 second, this would have been, you know, 3/4 of the way through my story, I wouldn't have believed you. But it's true. And I ended up buying this place with a retiring police officer in Indianapolis. She left in January of this year, and with awards. She was very highly merited and recognized in her field, and she's going to do just the same here at Griner's, the sub chef.
Now, people might know you because of Scout's Treats truck. So that's what they're thinking when they think of you, right? And not a sub shop. So that's kind of an interesting story, like you said.
Yeah. Well, it is. And the fact of the matter is that I am still Scout's, you know. And there have been times I'm driving down the road, or I might be in the pink truck driving down the road, and I just start laughing like, what? How did I get here? I'm in a pink truck. What? But it's good. It's good. And here I am. I left the corporate world 13 years ago now, and then some change. And now I have these three fun businesses. And it's kind of like my kids. If somebody were to ask me which one I love the most, I love them all and differently. But certainly Griner's is my new true love.
Well, now tell me, so you have the Scout's Treats truck. And Griner's, and...
And I opened up Indy's first dog treat food truck called Bark Truck. There are, I know, it's hard to say that without laughing, but there are a few of them in the country, probably only two or three others that I know of, so that's pushing it when I say a few. But I think you'll see a trend towards that. But we're looking to do something a little different with that. We're looking to be full service, and I planned on this winter, but with Griner's, that kind of set that schedule back a little bit. And as you know, when you own a small business, you need to be flexible with your timeline. And so, our goal with Bark Truck is to be full service. So you can go online late spring with us. You can go online and order your dog food, homemade dog treats, shampoo, flea medicine, whatever it is that we're selling online that we have in stock. And we will deliver it to your house. Some friendly chap will poop scoop your yard and be done with it. So there you go.
Now, so when is that starting, or has it already started?
No, it has not started. Our website will be up and running in March, and we're hoping to have that service sometime in March, maybe the beginning of April.
So you are a busy person, so you're not just making, you know, wonderful brownies and stuff like that. You're also making dog treats and now subs. So tell me, you know, the sub shop is just fascinating. Tell me a little bit about it and its history.
You know, I still continue to try to learn as much as I can about the history, and I feel like I learn a little bit more each day. I was fortunate about, I'm going to say 3 months ago, the original founder, Ray Griner's daughter, Kim, came in to the shop. And I knew she didn't have a ton of time, but selfishly, I pinned her down for about 5 minutes at a table, and I just started asking her as many questions as I could. And I do know there were a handful of Griner's for some time, and I also understand there was still one left in Japan. How's that for some trivia? But this is the only Griner's left here in the United States. This is it. Yes. And truth be told, on October 6th, it shut down. And I came in with a new offer because it was my intention to buy it. But I came in with a new offer on October 6th. And on October 8th, Robert Bennett and I reopened the sub shop. And people thought it was closed for renovation, which is somewhat true. If you look around, I've renovated. And here we are. And business is absolutely strong. And every single person that walks through our door is just, they're like a gift to us. Everybody is just as important as the person that left and the person that's coming in behind them. And, you know, we've got this canvas here. It's a huge canvas. I don't even measure that. But years ago, I saw this fabulous canvas in a design magazine, and I thought, oh my gosh, I love that. Well, the woman had her neighbors and friends and people that she loved draw their self-portrait on it. And I thought, what a great idea. So I had this canvas that my family was begging me to get rid of, and I painted over it, and I have, 200 squares, different colors. And we have people coming in, no kidding, every day that choose to on their own give us their history. Well, I've been coming since I was 7. I've been coming since I was, and these people have been coming since 1969 or the early 70s. And these are the people that we've invited to draw their self-portrait. And
how cool is that? It's neat. It's huge, and there are little faces, and people have filled in their faces.
Yes, I know. I know. I'm so excited. I'm going to have a little push here to get the rest of it completed, to have this up on our wall permanently. It really is a tribute and kind of a thank you to them this spring.
We've been talking with local entrepreneur Lisa Moreno-Moyers of Griner's Sub Shop and Scout's Treats Truck. For more information, look for Lisa and her business on Facebook.
Eat, Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health, providing care to nearly 1 million outpatient visitors each year with the mission to advocate, care, teach, and serve at its hospital and inpatient facility and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis. EskenaziHealth.edu.
When Tina Jessen moved with her husband to Indiana from her native England, she cast about for a business and ended up baking, selling her wares at farmers markets, and then hosting tea parties, which led to her opening Tina's Traditional Old English Kitchen last year in Carmel. And now the popular tea house has expanded at its location on Rangeline Road in Carmel, as well as at the Propylaeum in Indianapolis. I stopped in at the Carmel location not too long ago to hear about how the business got started and how it's grown. Tell me how this all came about.
Oh, goodness me. Well, I moved out to Indiana from England. I've come from the Derbyshire region of England, and my husband has worked for Rolls-Royce Aero Engines for the last 25 years. And in 2008, he had the opportunity to come out to Indianapolis, and we were just ready for a change, and I thought, why not? And I think he was a bit surprised when he came home, and he said he'd found a really lovely job that he'd like to take. The problem was it was in America. And I went, oh, where? Really excited. And he said, Indianapolis. And I went, where's Indianapolis? And he went, Indy 500. I went, oh, okay. So about a year later, we came out for a visit. That was in the April of 2008. And by August, we were living here. So, it's been quite a change. And the three things you miss the most when you emigrate to a new country is family, friends, and food. And I'm a bit of a foodie, so I started baking things that we couldn't get hold of quite so easily out here, things like English scones and crumpets and one or two other things. And I started selling through local farmers markets. I was at Traders Point Creamery back in 2011, and then we were at Plainfield and Zionsville. And then people started asking me about tea party catering and would I be interested. I thought, how hard can that be? Tea sandwiches and cups of tea? Yes, we can do that.
Was that anything you had ever done?
It wasn't, because I've never really been in service. I've always been a very passionate home baker. When the kids were small, we used to do a lot of baking. I used to get them in the kitchen and do all those kind of mumsy things that you do. And every Christmas, I would make Christmas cake and mince pies and, you know, do all that kind of stuff that my mum and my gran did with me when I was growing up. But you have to watch the waistline, because when you make a batch of 12, it's amazing, you know. So to be able to do it for other people has been absolutely wonderful. But I do remember when I first came out here, I was thinking, what am I going to do now?
Sure.
Kids have left home. I'm in a new country, need to make friends, need to do something with my life. And people have always said, do something that is genuine, something that's authentic to you. And I thought, well, I'm English.
Right.
I know how to bake scones and English food. And I'm much a foodie. So that's really what got me started. But I kind of remembered when I was in my late 20s, I'd been to a fantastic tea room in England and thought to myself, well, wouldn't it be lovely to run something like a tea room by the time I'm 50? Didn't think I'd be doing it in America, though, at that time.
That's kind of an interesting twist.
It is. It is. So, you know, when the opportunity came along to do tea parties and do all this lovely baking and sell, and people keep saying to me, oh, Tina, you know, I love your accent. And I never get fed up of people telling me that. I really don't.
That's good. It is very charming.
But I know a lot of people have said, you know, we don't care what you talk about as long as you're talking. And it's like, okay, so let's pick something I know something about, afternoon tea. So I became a bit of an expert, I suppose, learned a lot more about different types of tea. Because in England, we drink a lot of English breakfast tea, hot with milk, which we never have to describe like that in England because it's just tea, where here you do, because tea is usually cold over ice with sugar and such. So it's been a learning curve, I think, for both me and for a lot of my guests that I've worked with over the last 3 years. And I've always wanted to run the business through a tea room. But finding the right location, the right kind of foot traffic and the right area has always been challenging. And I must have looked at over 20 properties over the last 2 to 3 years
before I
found this place here in Carmel. And I love it. I mean, we're in a period building. We have a lovely kitchen. We're within walking distance of Main Street. We have parking at the back. I mean, these were all criteria. But to find that in one place at a price I could afford was out of my grasp. And then, as chance would have it, I came across the sweet shop here as they were downsizing their space and the other half of the building becoming available. It was like, this so could work. Okay. And I tried not to get too excited. And we opened in October. So,
now, did you know this was the space for you when you first saw it? You said you'd looked at lots of places.
Oh, you have no idea. I was so close to signing a contract with a property over in Zionsville that just was an 8 out of 10. And when I saw this, I just knew this was a 10 out of 10. And if I hadn't have put the work in looking at the previous property, I wouldn't have known how perfect this was when I saw it, which is why I say when I saw it, I didn't want to get too excited because I just knew, but I just didn't want to kind of go, all in one go and scare everybody off. So
now, what were you doing at the time? You have been doing these tea parties and baking and classes and that sort of thing, right?
Absolutely. And like I say, it started off small. I'm a big believer in doing a little bit with what you have. You know, what can you do now with what you have? And I started as a home-based vendor baking from home. But then as soon as I started being asked to do catered work, I had to get fully certified through a commercial kitchen. And I actually worked down in Indy's kitchen, mm-hmm. down in Indianapolis for a good 6 months or so while I was looking for somewhere a little closer to home, which is actually over in Brownsburg. And then I started partnering with other businesses because I thought, well, I'm looking for a little bit of space and a little bit of time in a kitchen, and maybe there's other restaurants or businesses out there that have a little bit of time and space available, and they would appreciate a little bit of extra rent. So I started looking there, and I worked with Dawson's 2 over in Brownsburg for almost a year. And then I partnered with a little coffee shop out in Danville on the west side, the courthouse grounds, and they were open for breakfast and lunch and closed in the afternoon. I do afternoon tea. It was like, well, this is kind of, you know, this will work. And the guys there were absolutely brilliant and very open to the whole idea of bringing afternoon tea to Danville. And we ran an afternoon tea service a couple of days a week for about 6 months before I got itchy feet and wanted my own place. Hence, we moved out up here to Carmel.
Tell me how it's been going since you've been here. You said you opened in October. How was the reception? Did people get it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it couldn't be more perfect for us. And I did do a lot of homework to make sure we were coming to a place that would appreciate what we're trying to deliver here. And for me, it's about really good English authentic food. My mission, if you like, is to be the most authentic tea room this side of the Atlantic. If we're going to put a mission, you guys might make it the bet top of your game. And I'm English, I use English recipes, we make everything from scratch, so that authenticity about the food was really important. But also I wanted to create an environment and an experience for people, because I'm very, very keen on sharing a little bit about the history, a little bit about the culture, so when you come here you get an education as well. And then obviously there's the ambiance and the actual setting, it's people come in here and say, well, it's delightful and it's charming, and you know, we've worked hard to try and bring a little bit of England into the center of Indiana.
We've been talking with Tina Jessen of Tina's Traditional Old English Kitchen. For more information about the classic British fare and of course the tea, go to tinastraditional.com or find it on Facebook. Indianapolis resident Gwendolyn Rogers had been baking for her family and friends for years and sending tasty teacher gifts to her kids' school and winning awards and getting her popular cakes into the hands of celebrities, musicians, and even into several movies. I checked in with Gwendolyn not too long ago as she opened her cake bake shop in Broad Ripple, which has quickly become a popular bakery.
When you first walked in, did you see the potential?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, did you?
I
really?
Saw it from the street. When I met with Charlie Mong, he said, you know, what are you looking for? And when I met Charlie, I had already looked at 4 or 5 other places. I had other people approach me saying that I want to buy a building. Would you want to put your cake store there? And I went and looked at all those other properties, and nothing felt right. And I actually I got as far as laying out my kitchen on that strip mall next door, and I actually taped out the kitchen equipment on the floor. I mean, I was close. I was about ready to sign the lease with Kurt Mart, who owns that building.
Sure.
And then I met Charlie, and he said, well, you know, what are you looking for? I said, I really want an old house, and I want to remodel it and turn it into a bakery. And he said, well, come with me. And we walked down the street. He said, what do you think of that house? I said, that's it. It's perfect. I was like, really? He said, yeah. You like it? I said, yeah, I love it.
Right?
It's taken a really long time. It took us almost a whole year just to get all the permits. But, of course, the whole time during that, I was still baking, and I was still, you know, giving things away to all my friends and making cakes for parties, and, you know, it just kind of escalated over the last 2 years. So now I have this huge buildup just waiting for me to open.
You have so many likes on Facebook. You have a big social media presence already for a shop that is barely open.
I know. It's crazy.
So how did all that happen?
Well, I used to be an agent a long time ago, and I also helped my husband with his movie stuff that he does. And so I'm pretty good at that. And I knew that I had to cover all my bases. I knew I couldn't just have Facebook. I knew I had to have Twitter and Instagram, and I had to have a blog, and I had to have a website. And I had to have a logo that was good enough. And when I first started, you know, I designed the logo myself, and it wasn't, I just didn't really feel, I didn't feel it. And my colors were a little bit different. I started with like a very light mint color and a lavender color. But I knew I wanted it to be something that would make a statement and would be classy just by looking at the logo. And I think I accomplished that, which is good.
Now, tell me how the idea came about, what you were doing before this.
Well, before this, I was working with my husband. He's in the film business, and so I was working on a few movies with him. So we would, you know, set up producer meetings, and at one point we had a film called Glide, which is about rowing, and it was we were going to shoot it in the UK. So we flew over to London, and we met with producers, and we got Tim Curry to star in it, and we had Rob Lowe wanted to play the lead, and so we got pretty far with it, and then for some reason it all kind of fell apart. Like, I don't really know what happened, but there's so much involved in getting a film started that I was like, you know what, I don't really like doing this anymore, because I put so much of myself into it. And it's what my husband loves, which is great, so he can go do that. And I thought, you know, what do I really love to do? And I love to cook. I love to be in my kitchen. I love food. So I made a list of what are my pros and cons. Like, if I'm going to do something, because my boys are getting older, you know, I have a 12, a 14, and a 17-year-old boys. And I thought, you know, everything I read is about food. Every magazine is a food magazine. Every book is about food. Every show I watch on television is about food. And every time I'm in my kitchen is when I'm the happiest. So,
did you have any?
Kind of how
did,
I thought maybe I'll start something.
Did you have any training in the food industry other than other than interest?
No training whatsoever. Yeah. But when all through my young adult life, I've worked in a restaurant my whole life. So I have done every single job that you can imagine. I've been the busboy. I used to clean the floors. I would take out the garbage. I was the prep cook. When I was 14 years old, I was the scone-making girl at a restaurant called Warm Springs in Sun Valley, Idaho. And I would get up early in the morning. I would ride my bike to work. This is I was in junior high. And I would make the scones, which is just dough that you would deep fry, and we would serve it with honey butter. So I would make the honey butter in the morning. And then another job I had in high school, I would ride my bike to a place called Lupe's Cantina, and I was the girl that made all the tortilla chips. And I think I was 16 when I had that job. So I've done everything. I've been a waitress for years. That's how I got through college. I've been a bartender. I've been a hostess. I mean, you name it, I've done it. The only thing I haven't done is own my own place.
So you know how hard the business can be then.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But rewarding at the same time.
And so knowing all this, having, you know, all that experience, you went into it, and even knowing how hard it can be to be a success in this kind of business.
But I love it. And I think if you do something that you love, I think the rest of it will all come. Even I don't know what hard means. If I'm happy in the kitchen and making a cake, how hard can that be?
We've seen lots and lots of cupcake shops in the last probably 10 years. But this isn't what people might think of as a cupcake shop.
No.
This is kind of way beyond a cupcake shop, right?
I think so. I think, you know, we'll have cupcakes because that's what people like. It'll be a different version, I think, of what most people are used to. But it's really more about the feeling when you walk in the door. It's the sound of the music. It's the smell that you get that's coming out of the kitchen. Everything is going to be homemade every day. It'll be the way you feel when you look at the glimmer of the light coming through the light fixture. It's everything about this place. It's not just about the food. It's everything. It's an experience.
Now describe the types of food that you'll have, the cakes, the pastries, the wine, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we have wine and champagne, which should be wonderful. We're going to do tea time every Tuesdays and Thursdays, so we'll have a high tea. And with that will come scones and champagne and little pedophore desserts. And, we're going to have the basic cake. I don't want to make it too over the top because I know a lot of – it has a little bit of a French twist to it. But I think some bakeries, it's almost an unapproachable dessert. And I don't want it to be like that. I just want it to make it you feel like you did when you were a little kid sitting in your grandma's kitchen. And I want the cake to bring back that kind of emotion.
Now, so you were in business, you know, working with your husband, and then decided that you were going to do this. So how did the idea that you were going to do something else become this? It's been, like you said, 2.5 years.
It has. Well, when I moved here, my husband's from here, and we moved here about a little over six years ago so that the boys could be closer to family and we could be with grandma and all that. And every school event, I would always make something. So whether it was a baseball game or a teacher event, I would always make a cake or bring food to wherever it was that I was going. I never did the gift card for the holidays. I always made a cake. And so one year I think I made like 40 lemon cakes for the teachers, because it's amazing how many teachers your kid has. Each child has at least 10 teachers, because there's music, there's PE, there's history, there's English, there's math, and I had to make sure I couldn't leave anybody out. So after all those cakes, every single one of those people said to me, would you make me another one? Or can I buy that from you? If I go to this, would you make me one? Well, then I thought, okay, well, I'll do that. Sure, why not? So then I would make cakes for other people, and they would go to a party. And then three of those people at the party would call me, and they'd say, would you make me the same cake? So the next thing you knew, I had so many cakes that I was making. I had to buy another oven. I had to buy another stove. I had to buy a fridge to put in my garage because I was running out of room. My whole family is like, okay, we open it up, and there's nothing but butter and eggs. We can't eat just butter and eggs. So that's kind of how that started, and it just was like a domino effect. And then I started looking at places to cook out of because I thought, I can't do this out of my house anymore, because it became that I was buying so many ingredients that it didn't make sense to just go to the grocery store anymore, so I had to get a distributor. So I had to buy bags of flour in 50-pound sacks. And then where am I going to put that? Well, my house is tiny. So I started looking for places to work out of, and I was just going to start with a commercial kitchen. I thought, you know, I don't want to open anything yet. I'm not ready for that. But every kitchen I looked at, like, it was too small, or it was dirty, or whatever it was, and I couldn't cook at that. So then that's when I started looking at actually opening my own spot. And then next thing led to another. I met Charlie Mong, and he's the one who bought this house. And then I worked with the architect, and then one thing led to another. And every day, there was not a minute that went by that I didn't think that I'm going to do something to get even closer to whatever my goal would be. And my goal at that point, then I was like, you know, I'm just going to open a place. I'm doing it. And I made the commitment to do it. And here I am.
We've been talking with Gwendolyn Rogers of the Cake Bake Shop in Broad Ripple. For more information, go to thecakebakeshop.com or look for it on Facebook. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health. With its 315-bed hospital and inpatient facilities and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis, eskenazihealth.edu. Local chef Jennifer Cheesem of Pierogi in a Pinch leveraged her popular farmer's market item into a brick-and-mortar location in historic Pendleton, Indiana. I checked in with Jennifer when her shop opened to learn a little bit more about pierogies and to find out what Jennifer has planned for her new business.
Pierogies are a Polish and Slovak delicacy that I grew up making in my family. And now here in Pendleton, downtown Pendleton, I open a shop where I can make pierogies, sell them frozen or fresh platters for dine-in or carry-out guests. Even we are doing holiday orders and special orders if anyone needs something other than for a holiday, if they're doing a dinner event or a catering event. But I grew up making them, and I'm so glad with over the years doing them at farmers market since 2009 that I can have my own location and bring it to all to enjoy. So,
well, now tell me a little bit about how you did get started in the farmers markets.
Oh, okay, sure. In 2009 was my first year at the Carmel Farmers Market. I started as a personal chef, and that was what I was trying to do, is marketing with my chef business. But I figured, hey, I haven't seen pierogies since I've moved from Cleveland, Ohio, in the Indianapolis region. And it was one of those things where I'm like, I know this. I can make the pierogies, and it's new for people, I'm sure, around the area. And a lot of people have come accustomed to it or was wondering what it was if they've never heard about them. But started creating them and just selling them, and ever since then people have just been asking for more and more, at least when am I going to open my location. But it's been great. Since 2009 I've been on and off doing Carmel and Fisher's Farmers Markets.
Now, what was the reaction at first? I would imagine there were some people who were familiar with them and were happy to find them, but maybe some people weren't.
The reaction all the time was, what is a pierogi? And I was so glad to welcome the whole tradition that I grew up making them, educating people and telling them all about them. All I've heard is that anyone in the Great Lakes region is where people are more familiar with having them. And the ones that were not, I just said, well, that's what I'm here to do. I'm here to have a special product for you, specially made for the area. There are some frozen ones everyone would always tell me about. They go, I think I can find them in the grocery store. But I said, it's really rare, and that's usually the chain brand. But this is an opportunity to make something fresh and local for Indiana to enjoy.
Okay, so tell us exactly what is a pierogi.
Okay, a pierogi is a Polish, and I'm part Slovak, so it's a Polish Slovak dumpling that traditionally you you make with fresh dough, and it has custom fillings. Normally the traditional ones are a meat, a potato, or what I grew up having was a prune one. But what I have done, I have made the traditional fillings and now have created my own gourmet, more new style age pierogies for people to kind of have taste that they're familiar with, but also to enjoy. And a pierogi is a boiled dumpling that you saute in butter and onions and serve with sour cream. So, of course, with all of our fillings, maybe the sour cream doesn't go well with, but we're also going to look forward to featuring some sauces that will complement them, too, when we open.
Oh, now tell me first about the different types of fillings that you do have, and okay. Your menu probably changes.
Yes,
but.
Yeah, the menu will change. I'm hoping to do a new menu every month, so we're kind of going to feature five different varieties each month, and then we're going to have a dessert pierogi we're going to have each month. Probably just do one of those, but rotate that out as well. Customary, we're going to have the traditional ones on the menu. That would be sauerkraut, a meat one, and a potato. So the people that are always knocking on my door are familiar with those. And there's one that is a very traditional one, is a dry farmer's cheese. And a lot of customers have been asking, if they are familiar, where can they get those? And I will have those in the shop for people to have. But the non-traditional, I'm doing a gourmet twist with, I have a beef and onion. So people that are familiar with having Italian, they kind of go for that. I also do a Polish sausage and sauerkraut. I do a combination. I have many more listed on my website, but for what we have now, for this month, the sharp cheddar potato is a top seller. That will always be on the menu every month, as so many people do enjoy those. And then I did a twist with pepperoni pizza this month, but we will just be rotating them as the months go. I really like featuring the dessert ones, but I also look forward to featuring more of the gourmet and savory ones.
If you could compare them to something, I mean, they do seem a little similar. People might be familiar with, like, the dumplings in Chinese food or other Asian food. But they're not, like, dumplings like you like in the American South, the chicken and dumplings. So I think it's a very interesting contrast.
I think a lot of people like to, what I usually say is, if they're not familiar, that it's like the pot sticker, like you mentioned. Or in Italian, like the ravioli. And more for Spanish and is more like the empanada, but the empanada is more deep fried. This is certainly a meal that you could deep fry, but it's traditional to just be sauteed and boiled. So, but we try to kind of give people a visual comparison because it's what they're used to when they go out to a restaurant or they see in their grocery store. So they know, oh, okay, I've tried a ravioli, Italian ravioli, that this should be similar. Or I've had an empanada. It might not taste exactly like that because the dough is different, but at least they know what they're going to try to achieve when they're eating their meal with their family. So,
now, what's been the reaction here in Pendleton to a pierogi shop?
It's been overwhelming. We found this great location in downtown Pendleton, and since we kind of took over the shop and decided to, you know, redecorate and do it towards our branding, that, you know, everyone was stopping by. We had our doors open. We were painting. We were meeting the locals. It's gone over fantastic here locally. So we're hoping to spread the word, spread the cheer especially about it. But here locally, it's great. I'm hiring locally. I'm meeting the local people here as well, the business owners here in downtown. So.
Now, did you always have this in mind, you know, when you started thinking about a culinary career?
Probably wasn't exactly this. I knew when I went to the farmers markets myself, when I, you know, when I was just looking around, I'm like, I don't see, like, pierogies, or, you know, I don't hear about a Polish shop right around the corner in downtown. I was always trying to find those places when I first moved here, because Cleveland is just saturated with the Slovak Village and, you know, the Polish places. And my biggest thing was, if there's not something that I grew up eating, I can certainly try to bring it and see if it, you know, people do like it and people do want to taste it. And the answer was yes. So it kind of, for me, was like from one business doing personal chefing where I was cooking for families at home and, you know, where they had their standard dishes they're used to having. But I always did the pierogies on the side to kind of to market both businesses, and the pierogi business won. I had to drop off the personal chefing because this is what took off.
We've been talking with Jennifer Cheesem of Pierogies in a Pinch in Pendleton, Indiana. For more information, go to pierogiinapinch.com or look for it on Facebook. Well, the do-it-yourself movement is gaining in popularity, and that certainly extends to food. All sorts of food, jams, jellies, breads, drinks, pickles, dips, and of course traditional baked goods. And you're likely to find all of those things and more at an indie food swap, a sort of cookie exchange for local food fans. Indie Food Swap founder Suzanne Krowiak tells us a little bit about what a food swap is about and how it's done.
Well, a food swap is remarkably like its name in that a group of people show up and we swap food. We swap things we like to make. Really, the only guidelines are that it's either homemade, homegrown, or foraged, but foraging is not a wild pastime, and some people do it in Indianapolis, but we haven't really seen that at our food swaps. Mostly what we see are people who have made things themselves, anything from, you know, pickles, jams, to breads, their favorite cookie recipe, teas, sourdough starters. Honestly, from Chex Mix to you name it, and it's probably been at one of our food swaps.
I think that's interesting, because I came to the very first one, yes. and I had chocolate chip cookies, but I felt like, well, you know, this is more than a cookie exchange, but that might be an idea that people might understand. You know, how you bring cookies to a cookie exchange and you go home with something. And the food swap is like kind of like that, but so much more.
It's exactly like that. And that you bring, and also the way cookie swaps traditionally work is you take home what you bring. So if you bring, you know, 6 dozen cookies, you leave with 6 dozen cookies, but different ones than the ones you made yourself. And that's also the way the food swap works. So it's a one-to-one swap, and you take home what you bring. So if you go... You know, one of the early food swaps, a woman, she just brought a pie. She brought one pie, and she left with something. Now, I think she probably wouldn't do that. We have had other people who do that, and they will maybe make a pie, and they'll package 3 really good slices of pie and swap that so they can break it up and get more for their pie buck, so to speak. So it is that where you go and you swap what you have. So frequently asked questions I have is, well, how much do I bring to a food swap? And my answer really is just to tell them, well, it's a one-to-one swap, so you'll bring whatever you want to take home. And so people generally bring anywhere from 6 things to swap up to maybe 12 or 18 or more. I would say the average is between 8 and 10. And by that I mean not 8 to 10 different things, although certainly you can do that. But let's say you are making cookies and that's what you're swapping. You would package up your cookies, maybe 4 cookies in a bag or some sort of... Some people put them in Ziplocs. Some people get very creative where it looks like it could be sold in a really high-end food... the artisan shop. So then you would take maybe 8 to 10 packages of cookies, and that's what you would swap.
Tell me how that works, how you get to actually swap your thing for somebody else's.
So what we do is everybody who arrives, and we do our swaps at City Market in downtown Indianapolis, and everybody gets a little table, and they set up what they brought. It is a ticketed event, so you can't just show up and participate. We have a limited, we cap it at 35 people. Generally, the tickets become available 2.5 to 3 weeks before the swap and tend to go quickly. And so you have to have a ticket to participate. So you come with your ticket and with your items, set up on a table, a small table, and then everybody gets what's called a bid sheet. And it's not a silent auction, but that's the imagery I use often to explain it to people, where it's a sheet of paper. So everybody sets everything up. They set out their what we call bid sheets, this one piece of paper. And then everybody walks around and takes a look at what else is available, what's interesting to them. And so then what you do is, so if I go and I try someone's shortbread cookies and I'm the one who brought some jars of jam, then I would write down, let's say, Jolene, you brought your, if I recall, salted chocolate chip cookies, right, which were very good. And I want to trade my jar of, you know, ground cherry jam for a package of your cookies, then I would write my name on your bid sheet and I would write what I'm offering to swap. So I would write my name, Suzanne, ground cherry jam. So we spend, you know, 20 minutes to half an hour doing this where people are walking around, seeing what's available, and then writing down their name on these bid sheets for things that they're interested in swapping. And then after everybody's had a chance to look and see who's interested in their items, we literally almost have a signal, you know, ladies and gentlemen, start your swapping. And then it's difficult to describe if you're not there, and everyone just kind of picks up their things and walks around and swaps. And so as I said, the bid sheets are really a starting point. So just because someone's written their name down, you know, it may be that, you know, on your way to them, you know, other people stopped you and that looked great. And so it's what I tell people is there may be people that don't want to swap with you. Maybe they have, you know, they don't like chocolate, so they're not interested in the salted chocolate cookies. But so maybe, you know, you maybe don't like ground cherry jam. So I wanted your cookies, but you're not so interested in my jam. So I just like, oh, that's cool. There's someone behind you who has something equally delicious. So I try to tell people not to take it personally, because you aren't obligated to swap with people. It is a barter. It's like, do you like what I have? Great. I like what you have. Let's trade. So one thing I do is really encourage people to not take it personally. If someone doesn't want to swap, it could be a food allergy, food sensitivity, just a food, whatever. Chocolate isn't their thing. Nuts aren't their thing. But people always leave happy.
We've been talking with Suzanne Krowiak of Indie Food Swappers. For more information on the next swap that's coming in April, go to indiefoodswappers.com. You've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Thanks for tuning into this week's show, and thanks also to our guests this week, Martha Hoover of Pattishoe Inc., Lisa Marino-Moyer of Scout's Treat, Park Truck, and Griner's Sub Shop, Tina Jessen of Tina's Traditional Old English Kitchen, Gwendolyn Rogers of the Cake Bake Shop, Jennifer Cheesem of Pierogies in a Pinch, and Suzanne Krowiak of Indie Food Swappers. And thanks to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio.